Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the You Should Run podcast. I'm your host, Tony Heil, council member in Bridgeport, PA, which, as you know if you've listened or you know me, is nestled between King of Prussia and Norristown, right near Philadelphia. I won my election in 2013 for the first time, was reelected, and the purpose of this podcast is to talk to people who have also run for office to get their experiences with why they ran, the challenges of running, and hopefully inspire people not just here in Bridgeport, where we don't really need any more candidates, but we need them all over the country, at all levels of government to get involved. My first political experience was in the state of Iowa, 17 years ago? So a while ago now. And now I feel old, but I'm going to talk to someone who's a little bit younger than me and more famous than me, unfortunately, because I wish more people knew my name. His name is Zach Walls, and you may remember his name from a viral video from 2011 in support of gay marriage and LGBT rights. And he's going to be talking not just about that, because we don't want to be defined by one thing, but about why you should run, why Iowa's great, and what he's hoping to do as a state legislator in the state of Iowa. So with that in mind, Zach, thank you for joining the podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure, Tony.
So, before we get into it, how's Iowa?
Iowa's mostly fairly cold at the moment. It's been a somewhat unusual autumn here. We went basically from summer straight to winter. There wasn't really much of a fall, but the state is certainly crawling with people who are running for president, running for other offices. We've got a competitive U.S. Senate election coming up in 2020 with Joni Ernst on the ballot. We've got a lot of reporters who are kind of wandering around asking if folks are planning to caucus and wanting to get their hot takes on the race. And I was in a good shape. We've got something like 72 days until the caucuses, so kind of hard to believe, but we're already in the home stretch.
Well, you say 71. I thought you were going to say that many candidates.
No, that's not too far off either.
Now, I'm recording this before Thanksgiving. This is probably coming up right after Thanksgiving. Are you still in mourning that Wayne Messam dropped out of the race?
You know, Mr. Messam did not, in fact, reach out to, I don't think, any lawmakers who I know. But, look, taking the initiative to get in the race, even though there certainly is, I think a big difference between being a kind of quote-unquote top-tier candidate versus the folks who are not in that area, it takes a lot of courage and a lot of hard work. So props to him for deciding to throw his hat in the ring. It's a big moment for the country, so I'm not going to knock anybody who thinks they can make a difference.
No, I'm not either, especially if they're being serious about it. But Iowa, when you're from another part of the country, people think of Iowa as just one thing. It obviously isn't. What's your place in Iowa like?
So I live in a community called Coralville, which is just outside of Iowa City, home to the University of Iowa, the Iowa Hawkeyes, which is part of the namesake of our state, the Hawkeye State.
Mm-hmm. And it's my favorite football team.
It's a community of about 20,000 people or so in a corridor area in eastern Iowa that's basically made up of Cedar Rapids, which is a manufacturing community largely, and also the namesake of a really funny comedy from a couple of years ago, and Iowa City, which is, like I said, home to the University of Iowa, and several of the surrounding communities in that region. It's definitely a very diverse place in Iowa. I know that racial diversity is definitely not a defining characteristic of the state, but like many other parts of the country, we are going through a relatively rapid demographic change at the moment. Something like 40% of Iowa's population growth since 2010 has been from immigration and refugee resettlement. And so we certainly are, and I think Iowa City is, if I had to guess, one of the most racially diverse communities in the state. We got a lot of folks who come here for undergraduate, for graduate school, who stay in the communities around the area. And for our county, at least, it's a growing area. Many counties in Iowa are either stagnant or declining in population, and that's a part of this growing urbanization that we're seeing not just across the United States, but across the world. And yeah, That's happening right here in Iowa, too.
So the purpose of the podcast is to encourage people to run for office. We've talked with a lot of people who had been thinking about it for a long time, have been participating for a while. Like my friend, Congresswoman Madeline Dean, has always been political since she was a teenager. And then there's a lot of other people who have gotten into politics since the last presidential election. Presidential elections always do that. But you were kind of thrust into politics, right?
Yeah.
So, what was that like?
Yeah. Well, so the decision to run for office for me was one that was born out of, like so many people, the 2016 election, watching what was happening both in my home state of Iowa and across the country. But the connection to politics for me really goes back a lot further than that. And it was probably in the early 2000s, 2002 area, where I started to get a sense that families like mine, families with gay parents, were somewhat kind of controversial politically. And then in 2004, for my first social studies assignment in the eighth grade, I had to watch the 2004 Republican National Convention, which was very late in the year, that year, late August, early September, and bring my thoughts about speeches from that convention to class the next day. And it was a very profound experience to watch Republican conservative politicians get up and warn our country about the dangers of the global war on terror, the ongoing war in Iraq, which was raging at the time, the dangers of terrorism, Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, etc. And then in the very next breath, warn our country about the dangers emanating from Massachusetts and the state Supreme Court decision that had legalized for the first time in the United States gay marriage. And I realized that they were talking about families like mine, talking about couples like my parents who were in a committed, loving relationship and who, you know, desperately wanted the same recognition that heterosexual couples get for their love and their commitment to each other. And that was a very troubling realization, to realize that politics is, like, very interested in me and in my family. And that was what led me in 2011, and we can talk more about this later, to give my testimony to the Iowa legislature in a speech that went viral. But then in 2016, after the election, listening to what was happening in our state and understanding that there were a lot of families who felt the same way in 2016 that I had felt in 2004, was a very powerful motivator for me to run for office.
And, you know, people who are listening who aren't friends of yours, aren't from Iowa, will remember that you spoke up in Iowa about this issue about marriage equality. And, you know, when I watch that and I see your background and the backgrounds of a lot of other people, you have politics thrust on you, or your life is political when you have... when one, you're gay, or two, you have gay family. Whereas I don't, like, I have the luxury as a straight white male, age 18 to 45, normal, I mean, I want to say normal, but, you know, average family background, to, if I wanted to, circle away from it.
That's a great point. I always like to remind people that normal is a word that we use to describe people we don't know very well.
Right. And so, but the thing is that, And I talk to my kids about this, because I have a five-year-old and a three-year-old. Like, there is no normal, right? Like, everyone's weird, and there's nothing weird about loving whoever, but I just mean, like, everyone's different. So, like, normal, especially these days, is not easy to put your hands around. So we should be working to make sure that everyone can feel, quote-unquote, normal and accepted.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, for me, a lot of this comes back to my faith. I grew up as a Unitarian Universalist, and we are defined by seven kind of core principles, and the very first one is that we affirm the inherent worth and dignity of all people.
Yep.
And that's a very difficult thing to do sometimes. There are a lot of people who we may have disagreements with, or have, you know, have very different ideas about the world, but I think that belief, for me, is really crucial, and it helps motivate my work. It helps motivate my values and what I do in politics, because if you ask what gets me out of bed in the morning, it's, again, going to work to affirm that dignity, that worth that all people have.
Yeah, and so, my wife and I got married in a Unitarian church. We chose the Unitarian church as well. And I totally agree. Once you have that kind of position, that first principle, it kind of sets other things up in the same framework for a whole host of issues, right?
Mm-hmm. It certainly does for me. And I think, I have very vivid memories of talking with my mother, Terry, who grew up in a more kind of traditional Christian household when she was growing up on a family farm in northeast Iowa. But talking about the fact that oftentimes Democrats struggle to talk about faith and how that is often a motivator. And of course, not everybody who's a Democrat is religious or has faith. But I think those of us who are, and especially to the extent that we talk about it in ways that include those who do not have faith, I think that we really benefit from reminding the people with whom, we are engaged that is a very powerful motivator for so many of us, because it is a really shared part of so many people's experiences in this country. And even though I think maybe the fastest growing religious group in this country are the nuns, that's N-O-N-E-S, not N-U-N-S.
Right.
But I still think that there's a very important role that faith and a connection to spirituality play for so many people. And to the extent that has been taken away from our politics, or that faith has been used in our politics as a weapon against some people, I think that's a huge detriment to all of us.
Yeah, I've been trying to encourage some of my more liberal-minded friends to join me at our church, our Unitarian church. Martin Luther King spoke there, not recently, of course. It's a very powerful experience, but there's so many people, because of what religion has become in the mainstream of conversation, that feel skittish about it, that think, oh, it's not for me, and they don't realize that a lot, not just Unitarians, but a lot of churches are far more inclusionary than you would believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed.
So you decided to run in 2018. What was the impetus? You said you were motivated by the previous election, but what was the impetus to run for the seat you ran for?
So there were several factors in play, and frankly, just to give your listeners a little bit of timeline here, I, in 2011, gave the speech to the legislature, and then I spent the next 12 months or so doing work in Iowa and then eventually across the country to help protect marriage equality in our state when we were still in a very fragile moment. And then in 2012, I co-founded an organization called Scouts for Equality. I'm an Eagle Scout. I grew up in scouting and really loved my time in the Boy Scouts and decided that I wanted to help use this notoriety that I had received from this experience of going viral to help precipitate change in the Boy Scouts, specifically as it pertained to their ban on gay members. And so we launched Scouts for Equality in 2012. I served as the executive director of that organization and helped lead that fight to successfully overturn the ban on gay youth and then later on gay adults. And then in 2015, after that work was starting to wind down, came to the conclusion that it was time to go to graduate school. I figured that, I'd be able to go to grad school, get my master's in public policy, and then go to work in the Clinton administration for a couple years, and then move home to Iowa to get married, start a family, and think about how to be involved in politics locally. As your listeners, I'm sure, will be able to surmise, it's not quite how it all worked out. The fall of 2016, when I was just starting my first year in a two-year program, we obviously saw the 2016 election happen. And, like a lot of people, I was shocked, is probably the only way to put it. And so I remember very vividly, actually, that it wasn't until a few weeks after the election that I started to really have an emotional, I was in denial, I think, after the election, like a lot of people were for a little bit. And a few weeks in, I had a very emotional response when I was talking with my former high school history teacher, who was still teaching at my former high school, and he was relaying to me what he was seeing in the hallway, in the way that even in this very progressive community, which is what Iowa City is, the way that people of color were being treated, the way that Hispanic students were being told to go back to Mexico, even though they were born in the United States, the way that Muslim students were being treated, And as he relayed what he was seeing in the hallways and in his classroom to me, it started to just sink in that if this is happening in as progressive a community as Iowa City, what's happening across the rest of our state?
Right.
And then further, through the spring of that year, of that next year, in 2017, Republicans for the first time in decades had a full trifecta. They had control of the legislature and the governorship, and they proceeded to launch a sustained attack on workers' rights, gutting the ability of public sector employees to collectively bargain. They attacked the minimum wage that had been raised in several cities and counties above the state minimum wage. They made all kinds of changes to the way that conservation dollars are spent to try and protect things like air quality and water quality. They defunded Planned Parenthood. They proposed a six-week abortion. I mean, they is literally the entire playbook. They tried to ram it through. And kind of amid that time, my state senator announced that he was going to be retiring, and that same high school history teacher friend of mine called me up to encourage me to run. He had been thinking about running for the seat, but decided the time wasn't right for him and his family. So he encouraged me to run. And so I had both some direct political mentorship that wound up being very, very important, and some direct and immediate support in the community. And so one of the things that I always encourage folks who are thinking about running for office is to try and identify who those mentors are, who will be your, you know, whether you want to say it's a Sherpa or a rabbi or whatever the kind of title is, right? That person who can help be your guide as you go through this process, because the first rule of politics is that you can't do anything alone. You have to have people who are on your team. And if you want to get something done, you got to go together. So that's, I think, a very important thing, especially for somebody who's kind of in the early steps of thinking about running for office, not necessarily here in 2020 or 2022, but especially if you're starting to think a little bit longer term, is build those relationships with people and try to get some guidance as you start to think about what this would look like for you.
Yeah, and not only look for who's going to be your mentor, but then once you do it, I think it's incumbent on you and me and then other people to become a mentor for others, because you can't do it as a first-time person getting elected by yourself, but also you know what it takes and why you need to get more allies in office at every level.
Absolutely, 110%. And that's something that I'm doing my best to be very intentional about now, looking for, and it was something that, frankly, I was even doing before I was elected. We had, I had several high school, junior high folks, college folks involved in my campaign who marched into politics over the longer term, and I wanted to make sure that they had opportunities to be involved and to learn, because in politics, there's really no better teacher than experience. You can study political science as a college student, but until you actually roll up your sleeves and get in the arena, it's not quite the same thing.
Yeah, you know, I took political science classes in college, and I'm sure you took classes or read and whatnot. Once you're in it, whether it's in an elected position, especially as in an elected position, or even just in the campaigning mode, you realize that it's very different than just what you read in a book, right?
Yeah, you know, to be quite honest, I didn't really take that many political science classes when I was an undergrad because, as mentioned previously, I was planning to become an engineer before I gave my speech to the legislature. But the experience of being involved in politics is, I think, in many ways transformative, mm-hmm. especially when people are, when they're listening as much as they're talking. This is one of the most important lessons that I've learned from Senator Elizabeth Warren, who I endorsed a few weeks ago, is that when you're campaigning, it has to be a two-way street. It cannot be that you're running for office just to get up and tell people whatever brilliant ideas you have or to talk about all the things that you've done in the community. The campaign has to be a two-way street where you are listening just as much, if not more, than you are talking and sharing your ideas and selling yourself. And I'll give you an example. One of the things that I learned during the campaign when I was running for the Senate, listening to folks involved with higher education, listening to folks involved in the business community, was that there was a huge waiting list for our local community colleges' adult English as a learning language course, which is offered for free to folks who are trying to learn English, who are adults. And they literally just could not, they didn't have enough staff to get people off the wait list, which is hundreds of people. And so one of my top priorities was to get onto the Higher Education Appropriations Budget Committee, which I was able to do. And then once in that role, work with the Republicans, because Democrats are very deep in the minority still, to get an additional $500,000 appropriation to start getting people off that wait list and clearing that backlog. And I was very proud that we were, in fact, were able to do that. And so that's really, really exciting. And my hope is that we'll be able to go back to the legislature here in 2020 and finish that fight to get that backlog completely off the books.
And that's why, you know, I was talking to someone else in Mississippi who ran, a Democrat, and now she's obviously in the minority there, and she's like, well, you don't build a majority by waiting for someone else to win. You have to like chip at it over years and show what you can do.
That's right. And even this year, you know, I'm super excited. We have a tough map in the Iowa Senate, but we are still seeing candidates from across the state step up, throw their hat in the ring, and get involved. And that's including in districts that are pretty deeply Republican. People know that these are going to be difficult fights, and so seeing people who are willing to take on something that they know will be hard and who are willing to work their hearts out anyway is really exciting.
Yeah, I think one of the few upsides of Trump winning is that there seems to be a lot of energy and engagement to run for every office.
I 100% agree. I was endorsed by and have been a very public supporter of a group called Run for Something.
Yes.
Which is started by some ex-Hillary Clinton staffers and some Bernie Sanders staffers to help encourage and support young people who want to run for state or local office. So basically anything beneath statewide office or congressional office. So if you're running for your local school board or your county board of supervisors or city council or for the state legislature, they'll help provide and connect you to resources that you can use in that race. You should be able, if you're interested in learning more, just Google Run for Something, or I believe their website is runforsomething.net, and that is the word for, not the number.
Right, and follow them on Twitter. Highly endorse them over pretty much any candidate, because I follow the people that work there, Amanda Littman. I think that what they're doing is the most important work happening in politics today, probably.
Yep, totally agree.
Now, I recently posted a podcast with someone named Maimona Afzal Berta, she's a school board member in San Jose, and her experience is similar to yours in that she's Muslim, which is different than your experience faith-wise, but she was surprised in her community, which is very diverse, to see all this hate happen after the 2016 election. There was vandalism, nasty words, and people didn't feel protected. Do you feel hopeful, though? Like, I was shocked to see, one, it happening, and two, how many people were just turned their back to it, or, you know, just said, well, that's how it is, you know, just let it go. What gives you hope that it's going to be better?
Well, I would go in no small part to what you said a moment ago about how after 2016 we've seen a wave of people get involved, and some of that means running for office for a lot of people, like my mom Jackie, who had, you know, she'd always gone to the Iowa caucuses. She had, you know, given a little bit of money here and there. But after 2016, she got much, much more involved than she had been previously. She joined a local strong women's group, which was born in part out of the Women's March, which she attended the day after Trump was inaugurated. And she, you know, she's very, again, in a very privileged position to have time and energy and resources to get involved at that level. But I think 2016 for her really was a wake-up call in that respect. And so that's being replicated all over our state here in Iowa, and I know all across the country. And I think that goes back to Mr. Rogers' quote that you should always look for the helpers. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people standing up to help out right now.
Yeah, and so I think it's, well, in some ways, that campaign, not just the president himself, but the campaign he led, brought out some of the worst in some people. It also brought out the best in people in the after effects.
Yep. Yeah, I would totally agree.
So, you know, you talk about encouraging people to run for office in tough races included in Iowa. We know kind of your views on things, and things are important. But if you were able to secure a big progressive victory in Iowa, what would that mean to the people in the state for not just your district, but, you know, winning a lot of seats there?
Sure. Well, I don't want to overstate my win.
I don't mean you. I mean, like, if you're able to help get other people elected.
From running in my race, so it was just me versus a libertarian named Carl, which kind of sounds like a band name now that I say that out loud, a libertarian named Carl. But Carl's a lovely guy, and he was running on a couple of key issues. He managed to still get, you know, 28 somewhere in that neighborhood percent of the vote, running against a much better known challenger. So hats off again to him for having the initiative to get in the race and try to fight for what he believes in. And but that being said, the district that I represent is largely based in Johnson County, home to Iowa City, Coralville, and it's one of the most progressive, maybe the most progressive county in the state of Iowa. But I also include in my district all of Cedar County to the east of Johnson County and a little slice of a county called Muscatine County to the south. Mm-hmm. And both Muscatine County and Cedar County are pivot counties that voted for President Obama twice and then pivoted to support Donald Trump in 2016. And so that gives me a lot of perspective. I represent 13 different incorporated communities and several more communities that are not formally incorporated, three different counties, a whole bunch of school boards. And so I really have a great cross-section of the state of Iowa. And so it's been really helpful for me as a progressive to get out and spend a lot more time in some of the small towns and rural communities that are still home to a huge, huge number of Iowans and whose lived daily experiences are, in fact, in many ways different from folks who live in more urban communities. And I know that some people not in Iowa, the prospect of an urban community in the state of Iowa might sound like a non sequitur, but it is certainly true that I think people who live in a place like Iowa City in a more urban environment are closer in experience in many ways to folks who live in larger cities like Des Moines, our state capital, or to some extent even a community like Chicago. The experience of living in a small town in Iowa, especially one that is not growing, is very different. And in some respects, I think actually that there are a lot of concerns about the future for yourself and for your neighbors that are just not necessarily the same as they are in more urban areas. But I think the fundamental challenge in both urban Iowa and rural Iowa is in fact very similar, which is that there's this growing gap between the haves and the have-nots in both kinds of communities. And that growing gap is threatening in more urban areas, I think, the stability of the community, and in more rural areas is threatening the existence of the community. And so I think for progressives, our goal has to be to tell stories and talk about the challenges facing our state and facing our country in ways that connect in both urban areas and in rural areas. And the only way to do that is to show up and to have a vision for the future that you can share with people and that you can actually take to their communities, talk to their newspapers, go on their radio stations, go to the civic groups that are still often very strong in rural communities, and share your vision and hear, again, to my point earlier, hear what their challenges are. And I think hopefully that's what my victory represents for progressives in the state, is the opportunity in many ways to start that process of rebuilding a Democratic Party that's going to represent all Iowans, not just folks in quote-unquote blue counties.
Right, and I think in my experience, and you've been involved in at least paying attention to politics for pretty much as long as I have, there's often then been this sense that, well, we're going to target the places we can win. These are the swing districts or whatnot. And you, if you do that, you end up running out of swing districts, you know, like that's why it's important to be encouraging people to run, in every county and every place possible to fix those margins and kind of chip at it.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to run everywhere. You have to compete everywhere. Howard Dean, back when he was the chairman of the Democratic Party in 2006, he got that 100% right to 50-state strategy, strengthening the Democratic Party all across America. That absolutely has to be the approach. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't be strategic and prioritize your resources. You got to do that too. However, the reality, of course, is that we for sure need to be competing in elections everywhere. Look at 2016 is a great example of that here in Iowa. There were several races that Republicans, they ran candidates not really thinking that they were going to be competitive, but then Donald Trump surged to an almost 10-point victory in Iowa after Barack Obama had won the state by 6 points only 4 years earlier. And that Trump, you know, tide lifted a lot of other Senate candidates running for as Republican Senate candidates for the state Senate that were frankly not expected to win. And so that gave them the edge that they needed in the majority. And that, again, teed up their reactionary agenda that they rammed through in those first 2 years.
So, but you think you might be able to win some of those back this year, right?
So our hope is that we're going to be able to win back several of those seats this year. We have four-year terms in Iowa for the state Senate, so those seats are now up again in 2020. Mr. Trump was actually, it's kind of hard to believe, he won a nearly 10-point victory, but his favorable rating was negative in Iowa on Election Day 2016. It's just that Secretary Clinton's approval rating was even more negative. But he hasn't recovered. He's been negative this whole time, and the impacts of a combination of both the trade war, but then also his EPA's policy towards oil refineries, which is very, very pro-oil and not pro-farmer, has resulted in a lot of people here, I think, losing confidence in him. I don't know if they're necessarily going to turn out to vote for, you know, Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, or even Joe Biden or Amy Klobuchar, but I think that they are not going to vote for Mr. Trump again. And so I think that there's a significant part of the rural vote that will probably not be participating in the 2020 election. Now, that being said, there's a significant part of Trump's base that are folks who are kind of traditionally blue-collar Democrats or independents who lean Democratic, who I think will probably stick in his camp again in 2020. But I think that we've also seen some very big changes in more moderate Republicans who live in Iowa's growing suburban communities, where folks are just really, and you're seeing again the same story in Kentucky and Louisiana more recently. And I think that we're going to continue to see that. I mean, we saw it in Iowa in 2018 as well. I think we'll continue to see that be the case in 2020. So there's an open question as to whether or not we can start picking off more of these traditionally Republican seats in the suburbs, which I think we can. And if we can win back some of those more rural and working class districts that we gave up in 2016.
Now, I have two last questions because I really appreciate all the time you're giving. One, this is such a weird dynamic, one that's new to you because you're a newly elected person. I have a regular job, so I don't go to work hoping that I don't go to work hoping my coworkers get fired, right? Like, I like the people I work with. It is a weird dynamic that on the one hand, like you said, you're looking to get the wins you can, treat people well, and then on the other hand, you're like, I really hope Bob loses his job. Isn't that like, oh, it's a tough thing to wrap your head around, that you're going to be nice to someone, work bipartisan, and also I really hope you don't come back next week.
It's definitely an unusual dynamic, and I think you have to, you know, again, because Democrats are in the minority, if you want to get things done, you have to be willing to work across the aisle. The example I gave you earlier about expanding funding for adult ELL programs through our community colleges is a great example of that. And at the same time, you know, it is absolutely true that we have different partisan ideologies or beliefs, or just, you know, to the point at the very beginning of the conversation, to different kind of underlying fundamental values. And so when you're working together to try and get things done, you know, it's going to be a little bit more noticeable, I'm sure, in an election year like this year, the dynamic is there, but you're able to work together when you have that shared concern for the people of the state and when you have a shared belief about what you can do to help them fix their problems or challenges. I'll give you one example. This was an item that popped up late in the legislative session earlier this year. Our session runs from about early mid-January through the end of April. It's popped up right in the probably first or second week of that last month. And it's about mobile home parks, which are being acquired by out-of-state investment groups that were then coming in and jacking up the rent 20, 30, 60, 70%. And, you know, even Republicans who are, you know, pro-free market folks could see that that's gouging and people are being taken advantage of. And that really, that's an opportunity where the government, the federal or state government, has to step in. And so we were actually able to get, working again with Republicans, legislation through the Iowa Senate that would have helped put some more protections in place for folks who live in manufactured housing. And unfortunately, that didn't pass the House, but we have been engaged. And in fact, literally as soon as we're off the phone, I'm going to be sending an email out to our bipartisan group of legislators to help set up our next meeting here during the interim period before session reconvenes in January to continue this conversation about what are steps we can take to protect these folks who do need our help and who we're trying to serve, because there are, I think, many opportunities to do that where Democrats and Republicans can agree on what we're trying to do, even though when we go to the ballot box in November of next year, we're going to have differences on what's on the agenda.
Right. I appreciate that. It's kind of the what you hope politics will be like when you're watching it. And it often is the case.
It is. You know, and sometimes there's less of that than you'd like. And to be very clear, the bill did not pass in the House precisely because of the influence of lobbyists and industry groups. That is exactly the antithesis of what we were able to do in the Senate. But that just is a reminder that, you know, you got to work hard. This isn't easy. You got to be willing to put in long, hard hours and be willing to give up the credit, because the reality is, if and when this bill passes, there won't be a Democrat's name on the bill. It'll be a Republican bill because they control the chambers. And that's just kind of the way it goes. So I think it was President Truman who said that you can get an enormous amount done when you don't care about who gets the credit. And that's certainly been my experience in the legislature. I actually, to my point earlier about the ELL thing, I voted against that budget, even though it included in it an item that I had worked very hard to get in there, because there were some other concerns I had about the overall budget. But then again, that's politics. It's the art of the possible.
Right. From my experience on a local level, your experience on still a local level, but like a bigger one as a state senator, the people who need to know that you did your work are going to know. You know, I don't necessarily know that I get credit for everything that happens in Bridgeport that I've done. But people know, they start to learn about your work. And so, you know, you start to learn what real credit is when you do that.
Yep.
So one last thing, you mentioned it, the Iowa caucuses are coming up. I caucused in 2004. It was fun. You know, what should you tell the public about? I know you said you've endorsed Elizabeth Warren, but is there anything that you think other people should to know about? And also, I don't want to take too much of your time, but this is the first time you're going to be like, I am an official person, so people actually want my endorsement.
Yeah, no, it's definitely been a little surreal, and I've been, you know, obviously, it's funny. I've been trying to take my ego out of the process as much as I can when it comes to the fact that you got presidential candidates calling, wanting to hear your thoughts or get your support or whatever the case may be, and just try to think about it in kind of like a third person, like, okay, it's not that, you know, Senator Warren called me, it's that she's making phone calls to young, you know, freshman state senators, she's doing the work. I think that's really impressive and speaks to the work ethic that she brings to the race, and also to the point that she's helped me understand more clearly that listening piece is just so important. She's fantastic at that. And in terms of, you know, the caucus experience, the reality is that people are as involved as they want to be, and they have opportunities to be very, very involved at the state level. So if you want to meet the presidential candidates and you've got a little bit of time on your hands, You can do that. You'll have from Joe Biden to Wayne Messam coming through, talking with people, holding events, and they're open to the public. People can go. You can take that selfie. You can have that conversation. You can read up as much or as little as you want about their policies. And so it's a pretty incredible process. And I will say that I think this time around, with so many, frankly, high-quality candidates in the race, U.S. senators, governors, various leaders of different kinds, I mean, Vice President Biden, and so many more, it has felt, I think, at times a little overwhelming.
Yeah.
That's true for me as much as it's true for kind of your everyday Democratic caucus goer. So that is definitely a challenge, and I think that as the field narrows a little bit, folks across the country will be very glad that Iowans put up with having these many people kind of roaming around here. As we start to narrow things down a little bit, it'll be a little bit more manageable for other folks. But, you know, in terms of what it's kind of like to be a state senator in this process, you know, I'll actually be hosting, as an elected official, a caucus site, so I'll be running one of the caucus meetings. I will be able to cast my vote for Senator Warren, but I won't be like a precinct captain or anything like that. So that'll be a lot of fun. It'll be my first time doing that. I'm really excited. It's kind of a tradition for a state senator, state representative to serve those functions in their own precincts. So I'm excited about it. And like I said, you know, we're 70-some days away from the caucuses. So as excited as all of us are for that, I think a lot of us are also excited just to get us one step closer to getting Donald Trump out of the White House.
I agree. But whether Donald Trump is in the White House or not, and whether you can caucus or not, whether you live in Iowa or not, you should take a lesson from Zach, and hopefully you'll be inspired to run for office. We both recommended the website runforsomething.net. It's a terrific organization that give you the tools you might need to run for office. And there are other organizations out there. Zach, thank you for being the mentor that you said you needed to. And hopefully we'll encourage some other people to get involved when they listen to this.
Absolutely. Thanks, Tony. And if you're listening and you're waiting for that last little nudge to get over the hump and decide to throw your hat in the ring, I hope that this conversation helped you do that.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Zach. I appreciate what you're doing in Iowa. Good luck. I'll be rooting for the Hawkeyes.
Appreciate it. Go Hawks.